This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Thursday, the regulator tells Australia's biggest banks to put hundreds of millions of dollars aside to compensate the victims of their financial practices. And bad news, the game aimed at protecting people against fake news trolls.
Well, the goal is actually to step into the shoes of a fake news producer. And the reasoning behind that is really simple. What better way to inoculate people than to let people step into the shoes of somebody who's actively trying to deceive you?
A day after its historic announcement, division is emerging within the government about the vote to recognise Indigenous Australians in the Constitution. The Morrison government yesterday committed to holding a referendum on the issue within 3 years. We'll come back to the political debate in a moment, but first let's go to Brisbane, where reporter Rachel Mealy has found many locals are also already voicing strong opinions on the referendum.
I don't think it's necessary. I think that the country has evolved far enough that we should just say the past is the past. Let's look forward to the future.
I think Aboriginal people have had such a long history here in this country, and it'll help their identity as modern Australians, and it'll help empower them as people.
I think that there needs to be a widespread public education campaign alongside the referendum so that people really understand what it is at stake here.
Of course we should. They're the first people. They were here before us. You know, I give great thanks we can even walk on this land.
Some residents of Brisbane there. Heading now to Canberra, and the pushback from a small group of coalition MPs on the Morrison government's plan for a referendum on Indigenous recognition. Here's political reporter Stephanie Boris.
There's no clear proposal on the table yet, but some coalition MPs are already raising concerns about making changes to the Constitution.
I'm struggling to see how that is actually going to achieve outcomes on the ground.
Liberal MP Craig Kelly is questioning whether the time would be better spent on addressing closing the gap targets.
The ultimate goal is not to just change a few flowery words in the Constitution that have little meaning. The ultimate goal has to be, the ultimate target has to be to uplift the prosperity of Indigenous Australians.
Yesterday, the government announced its plan to hold a referendum within the next 3 years on whether Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people should be recognised in the Australian Constitution. The Minister for Indigenous Australians, Ken Wyatt, pledged to bring forward a consensus option.
I want to focus on co-designing, so I get the best possible model and the best possible set of words for the Constitution that makes that long-lasting difference.
Former Deputy Prime Minister turned backbencher Barnaby Joyce is asking for more details.
I believe constitutional recognition is something that can be supported once it's seen. Obviously, you never give endorsement to anything without reading it first. Obviously, it comes down to the words.
It's what that wording will be that's causing angst among a small but loud group of backbenchers. Craig Kelly's concerns are shared by his Queensland colleague, Senator Amanda Stoker.
To suggest that putting some flowery words into the Constitution, if you think that's going to solve the problems, I think people are just bound for disappointment.
But Senator Stoker told Sydney radio station 2GB she is open to some changes.
We can remove from the Constitution, Section 25. Now, Section 25 at the moment provides that the states can provide for different voting treatment of Indigenous people. That's inappropriate. And I think you could pare down or remove the race power in Section 51, sub 26, because I think it's also inappropriate that we have a race power.
One of the other options on the table is introducing what's known as a voice to Parliament. It was a proposal supported and put forward by hundreds of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in 2017. But because it included little detail, it's led to some MPs claiming it would create a third chamber of Parliament. Supporters say that's not true. Speaking on Sky News, Liberal Senator Andrew Bragg urged his colleagues not to jump the gun.
Given the minister has committed to doing a co-design process yesterday, it'd be unhelpful for me to, canvas various models. I'm sure that there'll be a lot of commitment from across the parliament, including from the Labor Party, to try and, you know, make this process work and deliver a model which could be adopted at a referendum.
A referendum can't be held unless the coalition can come to an agreement, and the reaction to yesterday's announcement shows it won't be an easy task. While not large in number, the group of MPs raising concerns is loud and could derail the chance of constitutional recognition. But Queensland Coalition MP Keith Pitt is confident the party can work together.
It is obviously a difficult issue. It'll be an issue which takes a substantial amount of time, and constitutional change is really hard. There are very few which have been successful in our history.
MPs have told the ABC that the way the Prime Minister handles this situation is crucial to whether or not they give it their support. There haven't been extensive conversations about Indigenous recognition in the party room yet, and holding meetings to talk through proposals and concerns will be integral to how it plays out.
Stephanie Boris in Canberra. Thomas Mayo was one of 250 delegates to the Constitutional Recognition Convention that produced the Uluru Statement from the Heart that called for an Indigenous voice in the Constitution. He's a Torres Strait Islander man from Larrakia in the Northern Territory. He's also the former president of the Northern Territory Trades and Labour Council and is the National Indigenous Officer for the Construction Union. Thomas Mayo, welcome to the world today.
Thank you.
How concerned are you that we're already seeing division within the government about this referendum on constitutional recognition?
Well, it is concerning because the division is based on misconceptions about what we're calling for. It's a matter of not really listening again, and also, I think, taking the wrong advice. I mean, anybody that has read the Uluru Statement, anybody that has read the Referendum Council report, anybody that has listened to Indigenous leaders know that we are not calling for a third chamber to Parliament. There's no right to veto in this. It's a matter of being able to affect and influence those decisions that are made that have been poorly done to this date.
What about within the Indigenous community? I mean, the Uluru Statement from the Heart was a consensus statement, but could we see that consensus breaking down and divisions now breaking out within the Indigenous community?
Look, I don't think so. I think that there is overwhelming support for this. We have our differences. We're not homogenous. But since Uluru, where that was such a wonderful and overwhelming endorsement, we have overwhelming support.
What sort of support do you see in the broader non-Indigenous Australian community?
Everywhere I've gone, and that's not just, you know, preaching to progressive people. I've gone to, like, the Barangaroo Towers. I've gone to country towns in Victoria. You know, farmers, business people. People just get it, you know. It's a simple ask that we have a voice on the matters that affect us before the decisions are made. And people want this change. You know, non-Indigenous people want to repair that damage that has been done and to come together as a nation that can celebrate 60,000 years of culture.
Minister Wyatt was not specific yesterday about whether the constitutional change would include an Indigenous voice written into the Constitution. But ideally, what would you like to see being put to the Australian people in a referendum?
Look, he wasn't specific enough, but I must acknowledge that it is a great step forward from the Malcolm Turnbull dismissal in 2017. But what's important to keep in mind is that if this constitutional recognition is not near the stronger spectrum, which is a voice, then it won't be accepted. It must be substantive. It cannot be symbolic.
So the minister is saying we cannot afford to let the vote fail. Do you agree with him on that?
I agree with him. And I think that's a matter of his leadership, Prime Minister Morrison's leadership. This is their opportunity to take the lead on this and make sure it doesn't fail.
But are you concerned that this desire to make sure the referendum passes could mean that Indigenous people won't get the sort of recognition that they're looking for?
I'm concerned that if without that leadership and without the resources that are required moving the Australian people to vote yes, then we won't get the recognition that we deserve.
Given that we are already seeing division, how tough do you think it will be to get a yes vote on a referendum like this in all states and territories?
This is normal, right? You know, there's been a big announcement yesterday and everybody's scrambling to take a position. But I think with people mobilising, talking to their members of parliament, you know, influencing in any way they can, big corporates like BHP and Rio continuing to support this reform and more leadership from Minister Ken Wyatt and Prime Minister Morrison, I reckon people will take to this.
And you say that you agree with the minister we can't afford to let this fail. How damaging would it be if this did fail?
It would be more damaging if we do not try and if we do not throw everything within our capability to achieve this. Because the status quo is our people dying incarcerated. It's a shame on the world stage. So the fear of losing is not something that I have. The fear of a lack of leadership is more pressing. We need to step up and do this.
You've been talking a lot about the importance of leadership. How much confidence do you have in Minister Ken Wyatt?
I met him and, you know, he impressed me. He's the first Indigenous minister in cabinet. I think that he can be the leader that we've been waiting for.
Thomas Mayer, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Thomas Mayer, one of the delegates to the Constitutional Recognition Convention that produced the Uluru Statement from the Heart. Now to the latest on the Federal Police media raids. The ABC's managing director announced today that he's written to Australia's Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton to ask that the investigations into any journalists at the national broadcaster be dropped. The Federal Police raided the ABC's headquarters in Sydney last month, looking for information on a series of 2017 stories known as the Afghan Files. Joining me now with the details is political reporter Alexandra Beach. Alex, what can you tell us about this message from David Anderson to Peter Dutton?
Eleanor, we only have limited details at this stage, but this morning the ABC's managing director, David Anderson, sent an email to staff saying he was disappointed the fate of two journalists, Dan Oakes and Sam Clark, was still unclear. They were the pair behind those 2017 stories known as the Afghan Files, which formed the basis for the police raids on the ABC's headquarters in Sydney. Now, in that email, he also said the ABC has now written to Peter Dutton asking the minister for any police action against these two to cease, or failing that, he wants the ABC to be briefed on exactly when and how this is all going to be resolved. And he also warned that while the public trusts the ABC to speak truth to power, that the national broadcaster can't fulfil its legislative responsibilities if its journalists are being intimidated or treated like criminals. So this, of course, comes after the news bosses banded together to argue that national security laws were threatening democracy and to make that case for legal change. It's the latest part in that ongoing debate.
And international human rights lawyer Amal Clooney has mentioned these raids while speaking about press freedom at a conference in London. What was her take on what's happened here?
Well, yes, Amal Clooney is, of course, a widely respected human rights lawyer who has represented journalists targeted by governments for reporting on human rights abuse. And earlier this year, she was made the UK's special envoy on media freedom. So she was speaking at the Defend Media Freedom Conference in the UK. And in that speech, she gave several examples of dangers to press freedom that are happening in various countries. And one of those examples was the recent raids on the ABC in Australia, and she warned there are global and urgent challenges to media freedom.
All governments say they support press freedom. The right is even enshrined in North Korea's constitution. What matters is enforcement of that right, and enforcement depends on states. All the reports compiled on the state of press freedom in the world today say the decline is not only limited to non-democracies. And so we have to be vigilant. And we also have to know that what happens in a country like Australia or the UK or the US will be looked at by every other leader in the world and potentially used as an excuse to clamp down even further on journalists.
So Australia's Foreign Minister Maurice Payne was also at that conference. Did she respond to those remarks or indeed to the letter from the ABC's managing director?
She didn't mention the letter, but yes, Maurice Payne was sat listening to this, and she also briefly got up to speak from the audience. She defended Australia's track record, basically, saying that this is a liberal democracy that strongly supports the principles of a free press. And she also said Amal Clooney would be aware of Australia's efforts to push for media freedom on the world stage as well.
Alexandra Beach in Canberra, thank you. This is The World Today, and if you miss a program, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe to The World Today wherever you get your podcasts. Well, a corporate regulator has told three of Australia's biggest banks to put aside an extra $500 million in risk capital to compensate for the victims of their financial practices. It's also named 11 major banks for the hard selling of often worthless credit insurance. Here's the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
Consumer credit insurance, known as CCI, is often the hard sell when credit cards or personal loans are taken out to cover repayments in the event of illness or unemployment. But in the industry, it's known as junk insurance, highlighted in last year's Royal Commission when Commonwealth Bank boss Matt Comyn went to his predecessor Ian Narev, saying it was time to shut down the shady practice. Council assisting Rowena Orr QC elicited Ian Narev's now infamous response about holding on to the business.
And the last entry, temper your sense of justice, you also made during the meeting.
Yes.
And what did you understand him to be conveying to you when he said to you, temper your sense of justice?
Calm down.
The CBA is now one of 11 lenders targeted by ASIC over the unfair selling of credit insurance that rips off consumers.
Yes, well, of course, during the course of the Royal Commission hearings, when Mr. Comyn did make that remark, he had recommended suspending the sale of CCI because, in his view, it had been missold to 64,000 ineligible consumers. And, of course, we know what happened in the Royal Commission.
ASIC Commissioner Sean Hughes says the banks in question could face significant enforcement action.
Consumer credit insurance, as it's been sold by some of our major financial institutions, is extremely poor value. In the worst case, consumers who took out consumer credit insurance for their credit card debt received only 11 cents for every dollar they paid in premiums.
And not just bad value, but you say hard sell tactics like cold calling.
Some of this evidence came through the Royal Commission. There were instances where telemarketers were calling consumers unprompted and unasked for, sometimes under the pretense of offering them some other product, but really with the sole intention of trying to pressure people to sign up for this sort of insurance. People who couldn't possibly make a claim on it, such as people who were unemployed or weren't working enough hours per week. Some consumers were overcharged and continued to be charged premiums even though the loan they had previously held had been paid off. So overall, this is a very grim story.
And what sort of penalties or sanctions could these 11 financial institutions face if they don't clean up their act?
Well, there will be significant civil penalties available to us if we do take proceedings against these entities.
In a separate warning, the banking regulator APRA has told three major banks, Westpac, the ANZ and the NAB, to lift their minimum capital requirements by $500 million until they improve their risk management and properly compensate customers for misconduct stemming from the Royal Commission. Shaw and Partners banking analyst Brett Lemessurier says APRA is clearly worried about cultural problems within banks.
APRA is clearly communicating to the other three major banks, in addition to Commonwealth Bank, that they are very unhappy with their risk management practices and the culture of the organisation.
APRA says the banks in question remain well capitalised and financially sound, but that they're falling short given the misconduct exposed in last year's Royal Commission.
Peter Ryan. The reigning world champions of women's football might be celebrating their World Cup win, but they're still battling their National Football Association in the courts over equal pay. At the same time, criticism is mounting of the 2022 World Cup in Qatar, where human rights groups say construction of stadiums has killed more than 1,000 migrant workers. Now one football author is calling on FIFA to cancel Qatar and pay the women. Sarah Dingle reports.
Over 3 hours, the reigning women's world champions wound their way through the streets of New York, ending up on stage at City Hall. Star forward Megan Rapinoe took to the podium surrounded by American flags with a speech which wouldn't be out of place at a political rally.
This is my charge to everyone. We have to be better. We have to love more, hate less. We got to listen more and talk less. It's our responsibility to make this world a better place.
Right now, the women's game in the States is unashamedly political. At the same time they've brought home another World Cup, the team is suing their own US Soccer Federation for pay discrimination. Federation President Carlos Cordero also spoke at City Hall, although at times the crowd drowned him out.
U.S. soccer has invested more in women's soccer than any country in the world.
Despite a highly successful World Cup, the women's prize money is just one-eighth of the men's. And this week, football author Franklin Foer published a call to arms in The Atlantic. He's calling on FIFA to cancel the next Men's World Cup in Qatar and put the money into the women's game.
I thought, well, maybe we should take the money that's being poured into this corrupt, authoritarian World Cup and revert it to a much, much better, important cause.
He's talking about the host nation for 2022, Qatar, a country which has been heavily criticised for exploiting the migrant workers it's using to build the World Cup stadiums. Human rights groups say more than 1,000 of whom have died.
You know, the best estimate is that there's over 1,000 workers that have died. One major international labor group has predicted that by the time the World Cup starts in 3 years' time, there will be 4,000 workers who will have perished.
Fatima Yasbek is from the Gulf Institute for Democracy and Human Rights. She says although the Qatari government has made some changes, it's not enough.
The workers are being denied the right to free movement. Their passports might be confiscated. They need a permit to travel from Qatar, from their employer. The Qatari government is saying that they are reforming these laws, but I believe that they are not really enforced or implementing these reformation or these laws on the ground.
The World Today asked the FFA, how can Australia participate in a sporting tournament which has already killed more than 1,000 people? In a statement, the FFA said it aims to support its male and female national teams in playing at the biggest sporting events available to them.
Sarah Dingle reporting. It might sound like a training ground for fake news trolls, but social psychologists at Cambridge University say their game, Bad News, is aimed at inoculating people from fake news trickery. The game has been translated into 9 different languages with the help of the British Foreign Office, and Facebook's WhatsApp, no stranger to dangerous fake news itself, is now funding its own version of the game. When game developer and the director of the Cambridge Social Decision Making Lab, Sander van der Linden, joined me from Cambridge, I asked him how the game works.
Well, the goal is actually to step into the shoes of a fake news producer. So you're actually sort of gearing up to be a fake news tycoon. And the reasoning behind that is really simple. What better way to inoculate people than to let people step into the shoes of somebody who's actively trying to deceive you? And learning about their techniques, in fact, there are 6 techniques in the game, things like polarization and floating conspiracy theories and false amplification of your online presence and discrediting use of emotions and so on. And people earn these levels in the game, and by mastering the levels, you incrementally become inoculated against those very techniques. You know, you start off in the game impersonating Donald Trump, but instead of Trump, it says Trump with an N. And often people don't catch that in the first instance. They see the content, they think it comes from Trump's Twitter account, they believe it, they buy into it, and then, you know, you long before you know it, you're duped by one of these techniques. So that's one of them. The second is really about the use of emotional language. So you're trying to get people angry about stuff and you start floating pictures and content of things that might make people feel a certain way.
So does this game actually work to, as you say, inoculate people against fake news?
What we've shown in the game is that I wouldn't want to equate the sort of cognitive immunity with medical immunity in a direct sense. But what we find is that when you subject people to a range of headlines, fake headlines and tweets before they play the game, then people play the game for about 15 and 20 minutes, and then we test people again. And the stuff that people learn about in the game are not the same items. They're sort of these general techniques. And so, yeah, we find that people judge fake news to be less reliable after playing. And we also show people some real news items, and people don't change on those items. So it's not that we're making people just more skeptical of news media in general.
What is the psychology behind the game?
So the theory of inoculation is really based on the idea that preemptively exposing people to weakened doses of the examples of fake news helps confer cognitive immunity. When we looked at this, you know, all of the documents talk about fact-checking and debunking, and all of that stuff is sometimes just too little, too late. It comes after the fact once people have already been exposed to the misinformation, and it's so much harder to correct when people have already been duped. So all of our efforts were really based on this idea of pre-bunking and just starting a conversation about how this tool could actually be used.
Isn't there a risk that by showing these players how fake news is created, it becomes a kind of instruction manual?
There's a few thoughts we have about that. Ultimately, the game is not really teaching people how to ramp up a fake news farm or a troll farm. It's really just demystifying techniques that are already out there for people and being used against them.
WhatsApp actually helped fund the development of your game. Is Facebook, the company which owns WhatsApp, a trustworthy partner for something trying to prevent fake news when it's not only a prime platform for it, but has also admitted to harvesting its users' details for commercial gain?
Neither Facebook or WhatsApp funded the version of Bad News. So this is funded by the organization Bad News itself and the University of Cambridge. What WhatsApp has done is they've given us a donation to build a new version of Bad News that is specifically used for WhatsApp. They were keen to get outside help, and so we've received a donation from them to develop a new version of the game. They don't provide any academic input to the research whatsoever.
That's Professor Sander van der Linden, a game developer and the director of the Cambridge Social Decision Making Lab. And that's all from The World Today team for this Thursday. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ruby Jones, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
There have been calls for constitutional recognition of Australia's First People for decades, and it could be about to happen.
Minister for Indigenous Australians, Ken Wyatt, has announced plans for a referendum on Indigenous recognition in Australia's founding document, the Constitution.
Today we ask what that actually means, what it could look like, and how we got here.
That's The Signal. You can find us every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever else you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.